loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the United Nations said today that the Syrian town of Ghouta is, quote, on the verge of a major disaster, unquote, as humanitarian aid for the 393,000 people there finally began arriving. Local Syrians in parts of East Ghouta have been protesting against the armed rebel groups that have held the area for years, calling on them to leave and to allow the Syrian army in. Rallies have been held in recently liberated areas and parts of East Ghouta, which are still under the control of hardline Islamist militants. Next, the most restrictive anti-choice law in the country was passed by the Mississippi State Legislature last night, prohibiting abortions in most cases after 15 weeks of pregnancy. A legal battle over the law appears inevitable and could call into question Roe v. Wade itself. Then we continue our weekly series where we look at the most pressing political topics of the day. We'll look at electoral politics, the political parties, and the most important issues at play in the upcoming midterm elections. And then the FARC, former guerrillas, withdrew from the Colombian presidential election today after being targeted by a wave of paramilitary violence and after its candidate, Rodrigo Londono, suffered a heart attack. Meanwhile, in what could be a major shakeup in Colombian politics, progressive candidate Gustavo Petro is leading in the polls. And finally, we look at the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The United Nations said today that the Syrian town of Ghouta is, quote, on the verge of a major disaster, unquote, as humanitarian aid for the 393,000 people there finally began arriving. Local Syrians in parts of East Ghouta have been protesting against the armed rebel groups that have held the area for years, calling on them to leave now and to allow the Syrian army in. Rallies have been held in recently liberated areas and parts of East Ghouta, which are still under the control of hardline Islamist militants. We're joined from London by Ambassador Peter Ford. He's the former UK ambassador to Syria. Welcome back, Ambassador.
Thank you.
Sir, this is the first convoy of humanitarian aid that has been able to enter Ghouta for at least the last 5 days. I think the last one was partially disrupted on Monday. Do you see the situation changing at all in the near future? Is there any indication that these Islamist groups are going to leave or can be pushed out by the Syrian army?
Yes, there are certainly well-founded hopes that the end is in sight and that these Islamist groups will do a similar deal to what happened at the end of the Aleppo saga. You will recall that several thousand of them agreed to be bussed out with their families. And negotiations had been in train between these Islamist groups and the Russians acting as intermediaries for the Syrian government. Negotiations aiming at the ferrying out of the final diehard Islamist militants under escort of Russian military police, probably to Idlib. This may still be some days or more likely weeks away, but that is in sight.
I noticed in today's Lebanese press that the Islamists are currently holding approximately 51 square kilometers of Ghouta, and they run the risk of being split into two as the Syrian army makes its advance north. What would happen if they're split into two? I wonder if some would give up the fight and return to their home countries or their home villages if they happen to be Syrian, but I wonder if others would continue to fight. And if so, what happens then?
Well, I think the Syrian armed forces have had a strategy of trying to divide the area in two. First of all, after the aerial bombardments softening up, they went for the low-hanging fruit of the more rural areas. of mainly the eastern part of the pocket. And these areas have now been pacified. The Syrian government forces control approximately 50% of the entire pocket. The remaining 50% is virtually divided in two. And what this matters because it makes it slightly more likely that the jihadis in one or other can be ticked off through negotiation. And this is what the jihadis themselves are predicting. The ones, I think, in towards the north belong to the so-called Army of Islam, and towards the south, there another gang called Saylak Rahman, not forgetting a group of several hundred ISIS fighters. I think the Russians will try to pick off these groups one by one for a deal whereby they'll be bussed out. Now, whether these deals have been a good thing, looking strategically and long term, is open, I think, to debate, because the reason these guys fight on so long is precisely because they know that the worst thing that can happen is they're going to be bussed out. From the point of view of the Russians and the Syrian government, it's a plus because they don't have to lose so many of their own guys winkling out the jihadis. But it does have this unintended consequence that it makes a surrender more put offable. The jihadis can carry on and fight for the left civilian, and then themselves be bussed out.
Interesting. You know, Ambassador Peter Ford is our guest. He was the UK ambassador to Syria. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Professor, Ambassador Ford, you might be a professor too, but I know you're ambassador.
I wish, in my dreams.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about a headline that appeared in yesterday's New York Times. Russia's greatest problem in Syria, its ally, President Assad. Now, I'm going to read a couple of sentences to you and ask you to respond. Sitting down with President Bashar al-Assad of Syria late last year, a senior Kremlin envoy described the benefits to come as Moscow shepherded the Syrian conflict towards a political settlement, particularly in rebuilding the war-ravaged country. Then the article goes on. But Mr. Assad cut the Russian off, asking why, with the Syrian government so close to victory, a political solution was necessary at all, according to a senior Arab diplomat who was briefed on the meeting. And then finally, nearly 2.5 years after he intervened militarily to prop up Mr. Assad, President Vladimir Putin of Russia finds himself stuck in Syria, not quite able to find a solution despite having declared, quote, mission accomplished, close quote, on at least 3 occasions. While Mr. Putin's military intervention established the Kremlin as a major player in the Middle East for the first time in decades, extricating Russia from Syria is proving far more difficult than he envisioned. Because you actually, unlike the people who wrote the article and most of the people in this country, you actually know what you're talking about when it comes to Syria. Help us unpack that article and the headline, if you would.
Well, it's pure propaganda, which fits into a scenario that was helpfully described in a leaked British diplomatic cable a few weeks ago, which reported on a meeting in Washington of the US, UK, France, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan. And these guys worked out a strategy for the coming months. And one element in that was to make Russia pay a propaganda price for supporting Assad. Make Assad look like a liability to great Russia. That's what this is about. This article is obviously based on briefing from official sources, frankly, I literally do not believe the reported conversation. I find it incredible that a senior Syrian would have such a discussion in front of witnesses on such a sensitive subject. It beggars belief, frankly. No, this is propaganda. Anyway, it is simply not true and just wishful thinking that there are differences between the Russians and the Syrians. It's true that the Russians put more emphasis on securing a political outcome. And it's an open secret that the Syrians would rather have a military outcome. But, you know, the United States is not really doing anything to help a political solution come about. So it makes the Russians look better if they're saying that they're trying for a political solution. But they will certainly not be unhappy if at the end of the day there's a military solution that leaves their guy firmly in the saddle. Surely that's common sense.
Ambassador Ford, what about the sentence, quote, extricating Russia from Syria is proving far more difficult than he envisioned. Now, that's the quote from the author of the article. Now, of course, the Americans are not trying to extricate because right. They've just taken over about 30% of Syria. I mean, you never hear anything like this about the American actual takeover of Syria, uninvited, thus illegal. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we have 90 seconds left, Ambassador. Is Russia, quote, having trouble extricating itself from Syria?
It could withdraw tomorrow. I've seen absolutely no evidence that Russia is in any way uncomfortable with the way things are. Their casualties are minimal, considering the depth of their engagement and the length of it. It's been a very manageable and very successful, let's face it, very successful tryout for their weaponry and for making their position stronger in the wider Middle East.
Fantastic. We are always honored to have Ambassador Peter Ford join us. He joins us from the UK, and he is the former UK ambassador to Syria. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The most restrictive anti-choice law in the country was passed by the Mississippi State Legislature last night, prohibiting abortions in almost all cases after 15 weeks of pregnancy. A legal battle over the law appears inevitable and could call into question Roe v. Wade itself. We're joined from Jackson, Mississippi by Catherine Klein. She's the Equality for All Advocacy Coordinator at the ACLU of Mississippi. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Catherine, there's only one family planning clinic in the entire state of Mississippi.
And
this bill would put it out of business and would deny medical care to so many women. You've said to the press that this is unconstitutional. Tell us about that and about the tack that the ACLU is going to use in the inevitable court battle that is going to come out of this.
Sure. Well, I guess first to say that it's not clear that this bill would put the Jackson Women's Health Organization out of business, but it would severely impact how they do their work. And like I said, at the ACLU of Mississippi, we do believe that this impending law is going to be unconstitutional because it interferes with a woman's right to control her own healthcare decisions, something that's been upheld since Roe v. Wade and afterwards a Planned Parenthood v. Casey is the right of a woman to terminate her pregnancy before 20 weeks if she deems that is what's best for her best interest. So it's unclear if we will be the ones challenging this unconstitutional law, but we will certainly offer support to any organization that chooses to do so. The clinic here does keep a law group on retainer for instances such as this.
Okay, so this is an illegal law, meaning it's the law, but it's an illegal law. That's right. Not the law.
Well, it's not yet signed by the governor, but the governor
will
has
sign
said
it.
That he has never met an abortion ban that he doesn't like. So,
and it was passed overwhelmingly by the legislature, too.
That's right.
Republican-controlled.
So then what happens with an illegal law? There will be a lawsuit, and there will be an attempt to get an injunction to stop this law from being applied, because it is a violation of women's constitutional rights, clearly.
Right.
What's the legal, I mean, does the governor expect then to be enjoined, or will something else likely happen in the courts?
Well, what we expect to happen is, of course, that the court will issue an injunction based on prior constitutional cases that cover abortion rights. And then afterwards, it's just going to take a while to work its way through the court system. And in the process, Mississippi is going to waste thousands upon thousands of taxpayer dollars to try and get behind this bill that doesn't serve Mississippi women.
Catherine, the hook of this bill has to do with viability. And in Roe v. Wade, which was decided in 1973, that too was about viability. And the court ruled establishing a nationwide right to abortion where states were permitted to restrict abortions after viability, but the court didn't actually define viability. Now, you've told the press that no court in the country has allowed abortion bans for under 20 weeks. That 20 weeks has pretty much become the generally accepted point of viability. This bill marks it at 15 weeks. Now, you've said in the press that it's not based in science. It's actually, I have a quote here. You said, we certainly think this bill is unconstitutional. The 15-week marker has no bearing in science. It's just completely unfounded, and a court has never upheld anything under the 20-week viability marker. Is that the tack that you'll take?
We think it'll probably go along those lines. So Roe v. Wade actually measured a woman's right to terminate her pregnancy based on the trimester system. So anything in the first trimester, a woman had a right to decide. And then in the second trimester, the state had to prove that it was against a woman's health to terminate her pregnancy, which is a pretty high standard. But then the 1992 court case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, that's where we get the 20-week viability standard. And since Planned Parenthood v. Casey, there have been a number of challenges like this. State legislatures put out bills to lower that limit. In North Dakota and Arkansas, very recently, there were fetal heartbeat bills, and those restricted abortion at 6 weeks and 12 weeks, respectively. And those were both overturned on the premise of this 20-week floor, basically, that it's never been upheld in court that a state can set the bar below 20 weeks.
And this Mississippi bill is not an isolated case. There are similar bills being explored in Louisiana, Texas, Georgia, elsewhere around the Midwest. There was a bill in 2015 that was struck down by the courts in North Dakota that would have banned most abortions after 6 weeks. This is an ongoing battle for you and the ACLU, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, these bills don't happen in a vacuum. There are definitely interests that have a concerted interest in passing these restrictive policies. State legislatures are definitely getting help from certain organizations in wording these bills. And what they're meant to do is kind of attack the issue from different sides. And they're just kind of throwing darts at a board and hoping that something sticks. So it'll be 15 weeks here, and then the next time, it'll be 12 weeks, and then it'll just create an undue burden on women who are looking to terminate their pregnancy.
Let's talk about the class and gender basis and sexual basis of this assault against women's rights, because it's not only an attack on women, it's an attack on working class and poor women in particular.
Right.
Because those are particularly the women who won't be able to go out of state. Here's some statistics, John. In Mississippi, Mississippi ranks 49th in the country out of 50 states in the number of teen birth rate, the number of teenagers giving birth. Mm-hmm. Number 49. It's number 43 in terms of gender wage gap, meaning the what women and men make for the same job. One out of every three children, almost one out of every three children in Mississippi lives below the official poverty line. Working class women, that's one out of every, more than one out of every five. It's almost one out of every four working age women are living in poverty. These, and again, Mississippi is at the very, very bottom. So you have an attack by mostly male politicians, ideologues against working class and poor women. It's just it's a war against women. It's also a class war against working class women. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just another way that our mostly white and mostly male legislature is trying to undercut women, and particularly women of color. They're underfunding our schools. They're underfunding our healthcare. Another statistic is that Mississippi ranks number one in terms of infant mortality. Some of our infant mortality numbers rival those of third world countries. So what we're doing is we're not prioritizing the healthcare of Mississippi women and children. We're undermining it.
Yeah, that's what it comes down to. You know, Brian, an interesting thing about this whole case is that Mississippi has a Democrat as attorney general. And he's acknowledged in the press that less restrictive bills that have been passed in other states have been struck down by the courts. And the U.S. Senate earlier this year rejected a similar ban, a nationwide ban, because supporters couldn't get to 60 votes. So I would have to think that the courts are going to put their foot down on this and say that this is not constitutional.
Well, let's ask Catherine. We have 60 seconds left, Catherine. Where does this go legally, and where does the whole issue? I mean, clearly, step by step, incrementally, the ultra-right, anti-woman political forces in America are trying to undo and have, in many ways, undone the rights of women. But where does it go regarding the Supreme Court, for instance? We have about 45 seconds.
Sure. Well, obviously, certain interests are hoping that the court will flip. Several of the justices are aging, and given that administration has kind of vowed to wage a war against women and against a woman's right to choose, they're hoping that certain appointments will flip the court soon. Obviously, our organization doesn't want to see that happen. We're going to fight these kind of unconstitutional bans everywhere we can, and just that we support women and their constitutional rights.
Okay.
Yeah, this is an epic battle.
It really
epic
is.
Battle.
Yeah.
Ongoing. We were joined from Jackson, Mississippi by Catherine Klein. Catherine is the Equality for All Advocacy Coordinator at the ACLU of Mississippi. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series where we look at the most pressing political topics of the day. We'll look at electoral politics, the political parties, and the most important issues at play in the upcoming midterm elections. We're joined in studio by Jacqueline Lukman, co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation. Jacqueline, great to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's talk about Texas. You know, so much was made about the fact that the Democratic turnout in this Texas primary was at a record level. 1 million Democrats turned out. Much less was made of the fact that the Republicans also turned out at a record level. They sent 1.5 million people to the polls, which makes me think that Texas is not really turning purple as quickly as people thought it would.
I think you're absolutely right. I think there is legitimate excitement for this Beto O'Rourke guy. I think I looked at his issues platform. He makes me wish I lived in Texas.
I'll tell you, he's the first politician in the last 10 years that I've donated money to.
Other than Bernie Sanders, honestly, there are a few local politicians who I've supported, but I looked at O'Rourke's platform and I said, you know what? I see how this could be a thing. But turnout has been nearly at well over 80% across the board in Texas. So while O'Rourke's campaign is exciting and it portends well for progressive politicians in deep red states because his platform is very progressive, you do still have to look at the reality of the just the numbers, and you have to continue to focus on, okay, you still have to win over these deep red core value voters. I don't think he's going to win this race, but I think he's scared the establishment Republicans enough that they're going to have to modulate their message.
I think that's exactly right. And I'll tell you why. First of all, Ted Cruz is not very popular in Texas.
Not
he's
at all.
Never been very popular. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I think people are attracted to Beto O'Rourke because he doesn't feel like he's tied to some kind of semi-conservative, neoliberal ideology. The guy's a former punk rock band guitarist. He's a congressman from an urban area, and he has gone to almost every county in Texas. It's something like 255 counties. He goes even in counties where Donald Trump won upwards of 90% of the vote. Now, what I love about this guy is that he makes no excuses for his ideology. He goes into these deep red counties and he says, look, I'm pro-choice. I support gun control. I think we ought to have universal health care, including a single-payer system. And rather than people attacking him, they're actually standing there and listening to what the man has to say. Now, I can tell you that Ted Cruz is worried for two reasons. Number one, he gave a speech last week in which he said that Republicans have to turn out because, quote, the liberals will crawl over glass to get to the voting booth. Okay, so that tells me he's a little bit worried. Secondly, he's already devolved.
By the way, was that a new voter suppression tactic?
I think it might be.
Broken glass by the polls.
It is the South, after all. Secondly, he made fun of O'Rourke's nickname, Beto. I think that was actually very important. O'Rourke's real name is Robert. Beto is a Hispanic nickname for Robert or Roberto, right? Well, Ted Cruz's name is not Ted.
It's Rafael.
It's Rafael. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that he's already taken to name calling tells me that he's worried.
And that attack actually came from a radio jingle that Ted Cruz put out after he responded to O'Rourke's campaign very late. Because
he didn't take him seriously.
Nobody took this guy seriously. And you know, in deep red Texas, why would you? But when you go to every county and you are able to connect with voters on either end of the political spectrum, basically by saying over and over again, I think this is something that Republicans and Democrats can agree on. I think we can both work on this thing. These are things that we are both and we are all concerned about. It's that kind of language where people feel like, oh, he's not coming out here attacking me because I'm a Republican, or he's not coming out here attacking me because I don't agree with him. People will stand there and listen to that. But for Ted Cruz, the fact that he was already unpopular, mm-hmm. Plus the fact that this radio jingle ad that attacked Beto's name was not only hypocritical. I mean, it was obviously hypocritical.
It really was.
But it was also insulting to Hispanic voters. It was, of course you get what he was trying to say, but it was also insinuating that, which is the problem with the way conservatives deal with these issues. And this is how they mess up the concept of identity politics. They insult voters of particular identities by suggesting that they can't articulate the issues and that the only thing people care about is that someone is, quote unquote, like me. And that's how people are going to get them to vote for them. So that I thought that was really insulting to Hispanic voters, that whole jingle about his name, and also a part of the jingle where Cruz says that if you want in Texas, you can't be a liberal man. Well, that's interesting considering that Ann Richards was not only liberal, but she wasn't a man, and she was governor of Texas.
That's right.
So clearly you don't have to be a liberal man to run and win.
That's right.
In Texas.
Another thing we saw in this race was the fact that more women won their primaries this time than in any other time in the state's history, including one woman who had been attacked by the DNC. They wanted her to lose because they deemed her to be too liberal for that district. What do you think of that?
I think, again, the idea of progressive policies is a very, it's the populist wave, right? Even though people might not like sticking a label to the kinds of policies that these insurgent, now on the left, candidates are running on, they are realizing that establishment politicians, even Democrats, have not met their needs. So they're willing to take a chance, because a lot of people who are hurting financially really do feel like, okay, I've tried these guys over here, and I've believed these folks over here. Someone is coming into this field saying, hey, nobody's listening to you, and I am going to fight for you. Give me a chance. And a lot of people are thinking, okay, I will do that. And if that person is a woman, especially in this time, this political and social space where more space is being given to the marginalization of women in the public sphere, in employment, and in politics, women are finding our voice in politics, and people are listening to not just female politicians talking about women's issues, which are important, but they're also taking the time to listen to hear, wait, you are concerned about energy too. You're concerned about foreign policy. You're concerned about economics, the economy, and jobs. And that is important, especially in a deep red state where you're assuming that traditional values hold sway.
Another thing, too, has been fundraising among the Democrats. Beto O'Rourke raised something like $2.3 million in the last quarter compared to $1.5 million that Ted Cruz raised. Also, Texas is not as friendly to Donald Trump as some of the other so-called swing states. In Texas, Trump beat Clinton by 9 percentage points, which was a closer race than we saw in Ohio, let's say, or even Florida. That might put some Republican members of the House of Representatives at risk, including Will Hurd. We've talked about Will Hurd on this program a couple of times because he's one of the authors of Hurd Aguilar, which would have been the DACA bill, the House version. Will is going to face either a Hispanic male or a white female, and that could cause some trouble for him. He is an African-American man, a Republican, who has won very, very tight elections in a Supreme Court-mandated majority Hispanic district. What do you think about that district that shares 825 miles of border with Mexico?
I think that for conservatives, the way they have addressed the DACA issue and the immigration issue in general has been one of their Achilles heels. It's just been the thing they haven't been able to get right. And you see that, I think, in Texas, especially with the close margin of victory that Donald Trump had. We're talking about a deep red state that he should have swept. But I think one of the reasons he did not is because they are terrible on the immigration issue. Most people, maybe that's an overstatement, but clearly the people in Texas don't want to build a wall. That's not what they want their immigration policy to be.
And Republican congressmen along the border have made that crystal clear. They
Yes.
do not want a wall. We've got 1 minute left. I have to ask you about George P. Bush. This is the son of Jeb Bush, the nephew of George W. Bush and grandson of George H.W. Bush, who won a primary for Texas Land Commissioner. That office is far more important than most Americans realize. What's he really running for?
I believe he is really running to be the next heir apparent of the Bush dynasty. There's no other way to look at that.
I think that's right. I think he sees himself as waiting in the wings to be governor, the next Republican governor from Texas, and then he'll look nationally after that.
John, before we leave, I want to just help the audience also remember these facts as we talk about politics. One out of every four women, we're talking about women running, 50 women were in the primaries. One out of every four women in Texas lives officially below the poverty line. One out of every four women, and that means their kids are living below the poverty line. That's got one of the highest poverty rates in the country. What Texas really needs is to become truly red, meaning to get out of this whole framework and start to have programs where working class and poor people get taken care of and where they have some power. That's what we need.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right. And it's coming. Well, we were joined in studio by Jacqueline Lukman. She's the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The FARC former guerrillas have withdrawn from the Colombian presidential election after being targeted by a wave of paramilitary violence and after its candidate, Rodrigo Londoño, suffered a heart attack. Meanwhile, in what could be a major shakeup in Colombian politics, progressive candidate Gustavo Petro is leading in the polls. We are joined from New York by Mario Murillo. He is a professor of communications and Latin American studies at Hofstra University, who has covered Colombia for over 25 years. He's the author of Colombia and the United States, War, Unrest, and Destabilization. Professor Murillo, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you. It's good. Thanks for having me.
Well, this has been a bad week for the FARC. Finally get involved in mainstream politics. Things are looking promising for the country. And then Rodrigo Londoño has a heart attack. And on top of that, they're attacked by paramilitary groups. What's happening in Colombia right now?
Well, Colombia right now is focused primarily on the elections, the parliamentary or congressional elections, which are taking place on March 11th, Sunday. And then obviously the presidential elections, the first round of which are scheduled for the 27th of May. And once that goes into a second round, which it most likely will, because no candidate in the field right now looks like they're going to have more than 50% of the vote, the second round will go into June. So the entire country is pretty much focused on electoral politics. And in many ways, the whole issue of the implementation of the peace accords between the FARC guerrillas and the government of Juan Manuel Santos has kind of taken a back seat, even though many of the issues that are being debated, both in the congressional elections and the presidential elections, are directly tied to issues around the peace accords and the post-accord implementation process, which in many ways has failed. The issue with the FARC is that they launched their candidacy for president and for congressional seats after the peace accord was signed and as the campaign went along. In many ways, the FARC, I believe, this is my view, and I've been talking to a lot of people who I respect on the ground in Colombia who kind of echo this sentiment that despite the demobilization and the idea and the commitment to become part of the political life of the country, which is a great thing for Colombia, the FARC probably should have anticipated somewhat of a political backlash once it launched itself into a political campaign, particularly for the presidency. There was an initial indication that the FARC would not launch a political candidate for the presidency, that they would only stick to the congressional seats that were allotted to them as part of the peace process, as part of the peace agreements. They were guaranteed 10 seats up until for the first 10 years of the peace accord. So that would be up until 2026. And then after that, they'd have to kind of compete openly. And so that was palatable to most people. But when Timochenko, Rodrigo Londoño, the leader of the FARC and their primary negotiator during the talks in Havana, when he announced in November that he was running for office for the presidency, it ruffled the feathers of a lot of people, including people who support the idea of the demobilization and the political process. And I think he and the FARC kind of received it, and this is by no way to endorse some of the deliberate violent attacks that were being carried out against the FARC and in a lot of different places that they mobilized and that they were campaigning in. But they should have anticipated somewhat of a public outcry against them because they're not looked upon favorably in a good portion of the country. And so that should have been expected. Now, this latest turn of events after several campaign rallies turned violent, and there was accusations of direct sabotage being carried out by the right wing, particularly the leadership of the Centro Democrático, the Democratic Center, which is the right wing party of Álvaro Uribe Vélez, the former president. There was accusations that they were involved in these sabotage campaigns during the campaign rallies. So the FARC suspended their campaign initially because they said there were no guarantees. And I think finally Londoño earlier this week stepped down and said he wasn't going to run. And I think more of that was tied to his health conditions because, as you pointed out, he had some serious cardiac issues that that were being treated as we speak.
We're speaking with Mario Murillo about the situation in Colombia, about the election campaign, the focus throughout the country of the upcoming election and on electoral politics. I'm looking at Telesur, Mario. Read a couple sentences to you from it. Since the Havana peace agreement was signed between the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC, and the Colombian government, 50 people associated with the group have been killed in 44 separate attacks, including two political candidates, 28 former fighters, 12 family members, and 10 party activists. Meanwhile, over 200 social leaders have been murdered as paramilitary groups seek to take over territory previously held by the FARC. So my question is, how if this is the case, the FARC is demobilized, they were hoping and have entered the political process, but now they've suffered setbacks on a couple different fronts, including the health of their presidential candidate, and as you indicated, perhaps not fully anticipated blowback from parts of the population. And also the rise or the significance of Gustavo Petro's campaign. He was the leftist social democratic former mayor of Bogota. What would the mood be like within the FARC or the demobilized FARC? And two, who is Gustavo Petro? How would you characterize him politically and what are his chances?
Well, those are two big questions, Brian. I'd like to get to Petro in a second, but let's first focus on the first point you made. The violence and the direct attacks that you've outlined, not only against FARC leaders and former combatants who demobilized, as well as family members, but also social movement leaders who have been promoting and pushing on many fronts all the different issues that were part of the peace negotiation, whether it was issues related to land restitution to campesinos, whether it was issues of environmental and economic sustainability in the communities and development in the rural countryside, whether it's issues relating to the substitution of coca cultivation and the crop cultivation to try to develop the countryside in areas where the FARC were very strong up until their demobilization. There's so many issues in the peace accords that have not been implemented and are being, in many ways, the problem of the state not being able to implement and pass through and move forward on some of these commitments. But I think the most alarming one is the lack of security, the lack of guarantees that were part of the accord. The FARC for decades did not surrender and did not commit to any kind of peace accord where they would have to surrender their weapons precisely because of the lack of guarantees that we've seen in the past over a long history of violence against left and progressive movements in Colombia, including political leaders who were affiliated with FARC and who were not armed but who were part of a political party in the 1980s and 90s known as the Patriotic Union. So the FARC were always clear about that, and it was one of the sticking points. And it looks like, once again, the attempts at progressive change, economic, social, political change in the country that is being put forward not only by FARC but by many sectors of the Colombian social movements and whatnot, they're not being implemented, and instead there's been a backlash from the right. So we've seen these attacks, literally assassinations and murders that the government still does not accept as being systematic, or they refer to more as arbitrary. Some of those murders actually described as, love, issues of love and relationship type of things, kind of veiled attempts to make it seem as if this has nothing to do with politics or kind of the social movements. So that's a real strain. And in fact, it's put also a kind of a monkey wrench into the negotiations between the government and the other guerrilla group, the National Liberation Army, the ELN, which has also been put on hold precisely because some of these concerns. And it's in that climate in which this election is taking place. And for some reason, you know, the press is kind of like overlooking that in many ways. And I'm following the Colombian press on a daily basis, generally overlooking that and focusing on the kind of horse race that we're seeing unfold on the campaign trail. And that brings us to the question, your second question, which is about Gustavo Petro. Gustavo Petro, who is a former M19 guerrilla fighter and leader from an earlier group that demobilized back in the early 90s, a vocal critic of the paramilitary, and political establishment axis that has always existed in Colombia. When he was a senator in Colombia, he was very vocal and pointed out constantly the connections between the right-wing leadership and the political leadership of the country and strong sectors of the agricultural elite, as well as the military, etc., as being linked to paramilitary groups that were waging war in the countryside. Gustavo Petro was the former mayor of Bogotá, and he tried to implement progressive policies in Bogotá, but then he started getting attacked precisely by the right-wing in the country, including one of the right-wing candidates, Alejandro Ordóñez, who, as the fiscal general, I guess you could say, like sort of the attorney general of the country, essentially tried to take him out of the office of mayor. And he was essentially toppled as mayor of Bogotá. And there was a big backlash against him by the political right and by the establishment media. That notwithstanding, you have thousands upon thousands of people mobilizing in these rallies that he's been holding all around the country, and people are just really excited about his policy proposals, his denunciations of these nefarious links between the political establishment and the right-wing paramilitaries, his call for structural land reform, which he says until that happens, the country will never find peace, and many other aspects of development, economic and social development in the country. And he's getting a lot of support. And in the last poll that was carried out, the last few polls that have been carried out, for the first time we see Gustavo Petro in the lead. We're going to have to leave it there,
Mario. We've been joined from New York by Mario Murillo, professor of communications and Latin American studies at Hofstra University. He's covered Colombia for over 25 years. He's the author of Colombia and the United States, War, Unrest, and Destabilization. He's on his way back to Colombia next week. And hopefully, Mario, you'll be available so we can talk to you once again about this very, very significant election that's unfolding in Colombia. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Patt. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. Good to have you back, Steve.
Delighted to be here.
So this is actually a very strong lineup of ridiculous, out-of-context headlines.
And we have to remind our audience that this is just one millionth of a fraction of the bad headlines.
That's right. Steve, there are so many that I honest to God can't choose. Why don't you go ahead and start?
Well, North Korea is number one story in the news, so we should start there with this headline from the Washington Post today. Kim Jong-un wants to be seen as Donald Trump's equal. A meeting would do that.
Oh, my goodness. Do you think Kim Jong-un wants to be Donald Trump's equal?
I wouldn't if I were him, that's for sure.
Yeah, but, you know, is it so crazy that a head of state would want to be respected by another head of state?
Yeah, this is, I would say, a racist headline.
That wouldn't surprise me at all.
Go ahead,
Steve. That was the basis of it.
Yeah, it's racist, although they would say the same about pretty much any leader of almost any other country because of American exceptionalism. They pretty much think that the American president, even one like Donald Trump, who's currently being sued by a porn star, is head and shoulders above anyone else.
Okay,
that's true.
That's true. But they wouldn't say Theresa May wants to be seen as Donald Trump's equal.
Well, I'll tell you something. When I was working for John Kerry, the Greek ambassador called me one day and said, "Hey, I'm leaving. It's the end of my tour. I'd like to come in and say goodbye to Chairman Kerry." He was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at the time. And I went to Kerry and I said, "The Greek ambassador wants to come by and shake your hand and say goodbye." And he said, "No." He said, "I only meet with foreign ministers and higher."
Okay, so So the Greeks, too, could be the victims of great American chauvinism.
Yeah, it's this exceptionalism nonsense that we see now. We see it at every level. And this is the latest manifestation.
How dare Kim Jong-un want to be seen as an equal? The Washington Post, they exposed that. There's another Washington Post story, Steve, about North Korea that's pretty, well, it's ironic. This is an irony, I'd say. Go ahead.
Yeah, Rex Tillerson said, talking to Kim wouldn't be realistic yet. Hours later, Trump said he'd do it. The poor Rex, he's just...
humiliated again.
And remember, Trump was saying Rex is wasting his time by trying to suggest that there would be negotiations. This was back, 8 months ago. Remember that?
I sure do.
Trump was cutting him off at the knees when he said we should have talks with North Korea. And Trump said, oh, Rex, you're wasting your time, humiliating him
publicly.
So anyway.
The watchword of the Trump administration is this: a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds.
Did Donald Trump say that?
He certainly has been thinking it.
He's been thinking it. Okay.
If he thinks it all, I don't know.
All right. Let's go on. Let's see some of the other headlines.
Let's move on to the most ridiculous headline from the New York Times this week, which goes to Russia, but not Russiagate for once. A Russian threat on two fronts meets an American strategic void. So here's what this American strategic void is apparently not filled by reality. Here's from the article. The Trump administration has yet to offer a strategy to contain or deter Russia beyond simply matching the weapons buildup. Now, we have to remind listeners that the U.S. just increased its war budget by $80 billion, which is larger than the entire Russian defense budget.
The increase is larger. So Russia is about one-tenth the size, military budget, one-tenth the size of the U.S. Russia has 160 million people. There's no longer a Warsaw Pact. That was the old socialist bloc nations in Eastern and Central Europe.
And most of them are in NATO now.
And most of them are in NATO. NATO is now basically up on Russia's border, which whenever Russia has military exercises, the headlines in the West scream Russia is having war exercises, military exercises close to NATO troops, as if NATO troops represent a country called NATO, as opposed to a military alliance that's gobbled up all this real estate right up onto Russia's border. So what's the strategic void? What is it? It's Donald Trump hasn't. I mean, what does he need to do? What does the New York Times want Donald Trump to do to fill this strategic void?
Heaven only knows. Actually, a part of what they want to do was in another article, also in the Times, whose headline is this: State Department was granted $120 million to fight Russian meddling. It has spent $0.
I think that shows Rex Tillerson is probably colluding with the Russia. He's not spending that money. I think he is the Manchurian candidate.
Remarkably, the article talks about how the U.S. spends billions of dollars, not $100 million, but billions of dollars on secret cyber capabilities. But none of that apparently is being spent by the State Department. So, that means the U.S. is doing nothing, according to the New York Times. It's pretty remarkable.
And also, again, for our audience, where Russia-U.S. relations really pulled apart was after the coup that overthrew the corrupt but democratically elected government of Viktor Yanukovych, which is always described in the Western media as a pro-Russian government, but it was kind of playing both sides against the middle there. But the U.S. and EU wanted just a complete puppet in Ukraine. And Crimea, where the Russian Black Sea Fleet is located, the largest Navy fleet for Russia, that was about to become a NATO base. In other words, Russia would not only lose Crimea, historically Russian spot, but also lose their naval base, their biggest naval base. And then you say, we call that a strategic void. That's the strategic void. I mean, it's amazing in terms of the double standard and, lying nature of the Western media.
The old joke, how dare they put their country so close to our military bases?
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. But the other half of this strategic void, which I was just getting to, is Facebook and Twitter. They literally talk in this article about how, first of all, Russia, although they always talk about disinformation, but this article actually admits that what the alleged Russian efforts on Facebook and Twitter have, quote unquote, been simply to amplify and or distort divisive but genuine voices in the United States. That's us, the people who oppose the U.S. intervention in Syria, oppose the U.S. intervention in Iraq, and a thousand other things we could mention. We're the divisive but genuine voices which are being amplified according to this. And that's what they want to counter. And how do they want to counter it? Again, reading from this article, they want them to create a network of anti-propaganda projects. They want the U.S. to have some people posting nasty things about Putin on Facebook and Twitter. Apparently, that's the strategic void which isn't being filled. We're not posting enough bad things about Putin on Twitter, and that's what they want us to do.
Well, Steve Pat, you can remember back to the 2016 election where Mitt Romney was part of the anybody but Trump movement within the Republican Party. And then he went and met twice with Trump at Trump Tower, hoping to become Secretary of State once Trump actually surprised everyone and won. But now we're learning, according to some of the other headlines, that the reason Romney did not become Secretary of State was Russia. Russia stopped Mitt Romney from becoming Secretary of State. How did they do it?
Of course.
Amazing.
You actually talked, I think it was yesterday even, about the ludicrous nature of this allegation, because Mitt Romney was just being suckered in and made a fool of by Donald Trump. But what I'd like to point out is the media aspect of this story. This is a major story in the New Yorker magazine. And if you read it carefully, what they end up saying is they quote an anonymous source who says he believes that Christopher Steele, the author of this infamous dossier, told Robert Mueller about information from an anonymous senior Russian official who didn't know anything himself, but who was, quote unquote, relaying talk he heard that, quote unquote, the Kremlin urged Trump not to choose Romney as Secretary of State. So this is at least fifth-hand information, possibly more, alleging this ludicrous story, and yet here it is, major article, both in the New Yorker, and then various people have been quoting that. I mean, this is just one more example of what we could call the national inquirization of the media in this country. They'll print anything, on fifth-hand information as long as it goes to their storyline.
We have 90 seconds, Steve. We have to go back to another Elon Musk headline. We're following Elon Musk. We know that he's an all-or-nothing kind of guy. He's going to risk it all. Here's one. Musk's $2.6 billion award cheered by big Tesla shareholders. What's that about?
Well, as you remember, more than a month ago, actually, there was a flurry of stories in the media. We talked about this, about how Elon Musk was going to make an all-or-nothing bet with his salary. After 10 years, he'd get a whole big, a lot of money, or he'd get nothing. Of course, he already is worth $20 billion. But it turns out, now that that's actually becoming reality, that was just nonsense, because he's really going to be getting $2.6 billion. That is over 10 years, it's worth pointing out, which means he's only getting $260 million a year. So,
What was he supposed to achieve anyway for the big all-or-nothing to get all?
Well, he has to keep raising the value of the company. And that's actually one of the interesting things about this story. You know, under capitalism, things are produced for profit and not for need. But in this case, Tesla has never made a profit. The only profit being made is from the shareholders, because the stock keeps going up and up and up. So people who have been investing in the stock are making profit, but the company itself isn't making a profit at all. And yet Musk, according to the board of directors of Tesla, is worth $265 million a year for doing this, for creating this company, which is a good company making good products, mind you, but hasn't made a profit yet.
Well, we're out of time, Steve, but we're going to come back to this next week. So joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. Steve joins us every week. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can now follow us on Twitter, at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.